This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So the first thing that I think we'd like to talk about is the idea of embodied risk and the value of the body and of life. Both of your work addresses surveillance and health and the idea of embodied risk. Robbie, you know, you discussed the way in which increased like screening and testing and prophylactic treatments transform the risk of disease into disease itself. And Lance, you talk about how particular types of bodies, particularly bodies that are marked as queer or trans or gender nonconforming, are read as inherently more risky and also at risk. So what then happens when existence itself is deemed as risky, when having a body is seen as risky? And what does it then mean to have a body or even to have a life in this framework?
And then building upon Sheila's comment, I was wondering if you could also talk about the tendency in healthcare, both historically and today, to focus on the body primarily as a scene of illness, as a site of illness. There's like such a complicated economy of time at play here, where the present and the future collapsed onto one another, and supposedly healthy bodies become statistically likely for eventual disease and illness. So like, what does it even mean to talk about health today when we are all statistically at risk of some eventual kind of illness or disease?
To riff, let's say, on the question of embodiment and risk, and what it even means to have a healthy body in the current climate, I ask to show a clip. HPV vaccines, probably many people in this room have taken them, Gardasil being the one most common in the U.S., was sold to the American public through direct-to-consumer advertisements. One form of marketing of the vaccine was to post public education websites that would inform people about cancer risk. Merck, the manufacturer of Gardasil, has a page, I don't know if it's still up, called True Stories. And it's four vignettes, of which this is one of them. It's not a slice of reality. It's meant to look like somebody taking a selfie video in a car, but it's probably a multi-million dollar production value meant to have the verisimilitude of that.
When I found out I had HPV, I was afraid of a lot of things. I didn't know what it was. I was afraid to tell my family. I was afraid to talk to people about it. But over the past 6 years that I've had HPV, I've learned so much about it. I've done so much research, and I've talked to my doctor about my problems, and I've talked to my friends about my problems too. And it turns out that a lot more people know a lot more about this thing than I even thought at first. So there's that. It's important to know the state of your body. So to go and get a checkup with your doctor is ultimately the most important thing. As women, our bodies are so fragile, and we need to take care of them. And we need to know what's going on. So I get checkups every 6 months. I get pap smears. And every 6 months they come back that I have HPV. But it's okay. Because I'm healthy. I don't have any signs of cancer or precancer. But I would just say that every woman and girl out there should go get a checkup and should know their status at all times.
To the question of embodiment, one thing driving a lot of healthcare consumption and self-understanding of people's own bodies are things that are thrown out, like HPV screening and pap smears, which are meant to pick up disease early and allow some type of intervention to cure disease. They do that work, but they do a lot of other work as well. And one thing they do is they, once, you know, I was a practicing physician here in Philadelphia in the pre-vaccine era, and Penn undergraduates would come to my office after having an abnormal pap smear that showed HPV, and they were told by somebody at the Student Health Service that they had a sexually transmitted disease which was not curable, which was not even preventable by condoms, and that could lead to cancer and death in herself or some other people. and were beside themselves with fear and uncertainty. So the screening paradigm produces not just true results and false results to be dealt with, but a state of fear, worry, and work. And part of the embodiment is actually work. This woman has to get every 6 month pap smears and checkups and is constantly looking for some change, and what goes on probably affects her, I'm sure, her intimate life and concerns and fears as well. And what the vaccine, the reason why this artifact, I'd love to have a discussion about this in your thoughts, but I think one of the more naked, obvious things about this artifact is that the vaccine, which is literally regulated and sold as a cancer preventative, is actually has another target, another thing that it's promising to do. And what it's promising to do is to not end up like a woman like this. Regardless of whether you ever have get cancer, whatever the probabilities are, there's a state of risk. It's a lived embodied experience produced by medical knowledge and screening and interventions that is associated with work and worry, and it itself is the object of prevention. In fact, my own daughter, who turned like 20 when the vaccine was first produced, I said, go get this vaccine before I saw this artifact, because I'd seen all those Penn undergraduates who ended up, I didn't want her to end up, I wasn't really concerned about her getting cancer. There's pap smears, and cervical cancer happens to be, a whole other story about where the actual disease is. And there, by the way, there's a lot of other diseases besides cervical cancer that we can get to that have to do with sexuality and gender and a lot of other issues. But in any event, I was worried about her becoming like a woman in this video, and they're marketing it as a way of avoiding the state of risk by having, and in this sense, something like a cancer preventative vaccine is not just like mumps and rubella and measles vaccines. It's a little bit like a statin or a lot of other medicines which promise some reduction of probabilities of disease, and in a way are sold by fear, are promoted as fear reducing, but then we can get to it later on, maybe reduce their own fear. So the embodiment to me, what's driving it, at least in some fraction of the health economy and society, is a cycle of interventions that produce knowledge, that create states of risk, which then themselves invite some kind of intervention, which often carry other risks. It's in a, kind of in an infinite sort of egress. And what is health? She says she's healthy. And I think it's somewhat ironic. I don't know what you think. You know, when she says that at the moment, I'm okay. They come back, there's an affect word split, in this video. Ironically, I think in some sense, getting screening tests, eating the right diet, compliance with various health recommendations have not only become, as there seem to be literally are, means to health, but become the definition of health themselves. I can't tell you how many people I run into, how are you doing? Good, my cholesterol's okay, I'm eating well, I'm avoiding cheeseburgers. These things become the very definition of health. Because so much of our medicine is risk-centered. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, can everybody hear me okay? I'm not sure with this Britney Spears mic, if I've got it on right. Okay. Madonna. Yeah, Madonna, Janet Jackson, take your pick. So I love looking at this commercial, by the way. It's particular dedication to cinema verite.
Yes.
Sort of recreating the sense it looks like it's real found footage, yeah. What have you. One of the things I want you to take from that, and the first time I'm watching this, though, is you can really glean that the notion of risk has as much to do with narrative and tone and tenor and pitch for that ad as much as it has to do with actual the tangibilities, the practicalities, the technicalities of when is someone infecting or not. It's interesting, this is a particular strategy of Gardasil's. Gardasil is most famous perhaps for a series of ads that they did in the early years when the virus, I'm sorry, when the vaccine was first put forward. It was an entire series of ads called Gardasil Girls. If you don't remember this, I'm a Gardasil girl, I'm a Gardasil girl. And where there's a degree of somberness.
Multiple languages and things
multiple
like that,
languages, multiple perspectives. And while there is a degree of somberness, even resignation, hope at the sense of I've accepted who I am. This is, have a nice day. This is a downer, this particular commercial is supposed to be. The Gardasil ad one, I mean, it's like every girl is like a badass. They're playing drums, skateboarding, rock star practice. I'm a Gardasil girl. And which is to say, what's being marketed, what's being advertised, what's being disseminated. And when we talk about disease transmission, when we talk about information transmission, they're both forms of dissemination. These ads and the very notions of risk actually sort of bounce back and forth between what we think of as being real, tangible notions, and particularly when it comes to contagious disease, tangible notions of epidemic. There's a famous theorist, a queer theorist and health scientist, a health theorist named Paul Treichle, who talks about it. For every epidemic that is literal, there is also an epidemic of signification. How in sign, how in discourse, how is there a dissemination? And those disseminations can be good in terms of edifying and educating and getting people aware and more conversant and fluent in talking about real epidemics, real contagions. But they also have the potential to disseminate fear and stigma and alarm and paranoia for purposes of selling drugs or for purposes of changing the pitch and tone of a conversation around how things are understood. If I had to talk about sort of what's healthy or how is the body seen as a site, I'm just picking up here when you were talking to me a bit, Sheila, about sort of thinking about how are queer bodies and how are bodies that are trans or gender non-normative understood. The disruptiveness of bodies has a lot to do with, if not that they are infected agents or contagious agents, but they have the potential to be. So what categorizes certain kinds of bodies for that particular degree of scrutiny? Anomaly is one thing. That body is different. The notion that, for example, a body may be atypical, the fact that it might not be fixed. In fact, one of the things about gender non-normative and trans bodies more generally is this idea of bodies can be fluid, bodies can morph, bodies have a kind of protean quality to them on their own and sometimes with our own volition, basically. Which is to say, then, one of the ways that bodies get deemed risky sometimes is when we think about their stability or instability. You asked about that sense of time collapsing and the future self that might be sick and the present self that's well, and we don't want those two ever to meet, basically. I mean, life is finite, life is risky. Life is risky because the things that make up life are sometimes risky. Sex is risky. Love is risky. Traveling can be risky, so to speak. So to think about whether or not a certain body or a certain life is risky or not is actually interesting because at some point we're all going to be within that particular sphere of risky or not. I'll just end with one more anecdote because I know you've got some more questions. When you ask what counts as healthy, I ask this question a lot of my students, particularly when I'm teaching about sort of the history of medicine as relates to LGBTQ individuals. If we took just a snippet of sort of the middle of the 20th century, let's just say the 1960s through the 1990s. In the 1960s, if you asked your average sort of American person who identified or was in touch with the fact that they were homosexual or lesbian, what does a healthy lesbian or homosexual person look like in the 1960s? Well, if they're called healthy, they're probably not acting on their sexual attractions. They're probably trying to live a straight life, and they're probably seeking medical or psychological counseling to help sublimate that. That's what healthy probably looks like. 10 years later in the 1970s, when the DSM has the term homosexuality removed from its, the APA has it removed from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, homosexuality is no longer labeled disease in the same way. And with the sexual revolution, with the move to sort of come out of the closet and the creation of gay communities, what does a healthy homosexual look like in the 1970s? Well, it's probably somebody who's out. Somebody who, rather than ashamed of their sexual activity, is acting on it. In fact, I bet if you asked most particular gay men in the 1970s on the street who were out and living open gay lives, are you a healthy homosexual? Their first answer would probably be, yeah, I got a test yesterday. I'm totally clear of gonorrhea and VD. I'm totally fine. Healthy sort of meant paying attentive to the thing. You ask a gay person in the 1980s, are you healthy? We all know that's code for do you have AIDS or don't you, basically. What is it when you ask a person who's lesbian, gay, or trans today? What counts as healthy? And I think the important thing to know is whether we're talking psychologically or whether we're talking in terms of disease transmission, it's sort of an ever-moving target, basically. Predicated in some degrees on the medicine, the actual epidemic, the actual illness, the actual diagnosis, but also on that signification. How have we disseminated what looks and what counts as healthy?
riff on two things Lance said. Those empowered commercials, which were the ones that were used for direct-to-consumer advertising, as you know, the FDA regulations insist that you tell people about the side effects and complications. And in a lot of those advertisements, they had a very ingenious way of, in your marketing a vaccine to adolescents, the mother figure came up and said, here's what could go wrong, which was an interesting use of like adolescent, you know, who's going to believe the mother, you know, and when you're selling adolescent rebellion and entitlement and whatever. It was a really interesting use of gender and family norms to essentially subvert the message of what's potentially dangerous about the vaccine. And I couldn't resist the notion that what was not done initially in either the regulation and the licensing of this vaccine, and certainly it continues not to be marketed as a vaccine for boys, even though boys, men get HPV-related disease. Largely, it's homosexual men getting rectal cancer, but also women get anal cancer, which it's a thing you never want to mention in an advertisement anywhere. And so, you know, straight through in everything about this vaccine, the question of who the appropriate market was dissonant with the actual harm that HPV causes and the harm it could be prevented by the vaccine. Mm-hmm. Somewhat fixed later on, but.
I love also when you see these ads and there is that moment where they have, they're required by law to list all the side effects.
Yeah.
I love your example about the mom mouthing them because 9 out of 10 times the voiceover does it and does it as fast as they can. Be careful, may cause side effects included, blah, blah, blah. And at that point, the visuals change. They show people on the beach playing volleyball and stuff. Like they're trying to pull you away in the other direction. One thing you should find interesting, if you're looking at an ad on TV where you see pharmaceutical ads, basically, all of them are required by law to also say at some point in the bottom, see our ad in Shape Magazine, see our ad in TV Guide or what have you, because if you've seen a pharmaceutical ad in a print magazine, they're required to print pages of things like side effects and worrisome causes. So how the risk by law is necessitated to be mentioned and in what ways it's delivered are sort of sometimes like that. Anyway, guess more.
Thank you so much. So I have a two-part question, and Sheila's going to join me in this. I was wondering if you could talk about patienthood and the politics of waiting. What kind of patient subjectivity does waiting produce? And how does the conversation around fear and fear and uncertainty that you were speaking about earlier, how does that connect with the experience of waiting? We spend so much time waiting in healthcare settings, so what can be done about this? So that's the first question. The second part really builds upon, Robbie, what I think is like a throwaway line in Risky Medicine, right? The discussion around how we need to sometimes turn ourselves into we need to think about being a patient as a full-time career and to navigate a healthcare system, an increasingly bureaucratic and institutionalized healthcare system, to make the best decisions for ourselves. We have to approach it as we would any career.
Sheila? I'm just wondering why you use the word career. I mean, that's particularly interesting. And how does thinking about a patient as career change our understanding of patienthood broadly? What does it mean for a patient to have agency to make decisions for themselves in this context? And does it matter? Are they listened to? Like, who cares about it?
Okay. So I'll try to partially answer these questions, and hopefully Lance has some thoughts. I'm sure he does thoughts too. Waiting. Let me use something. You know, I'm a clinician, and so clinical examples come to mind. One of the curious things, if nobody in this audience, I think, is approaching my age, it's kind of hard to resist getting screened for prostate cancer if you're a male and as you get older. And it's a very frequent finding that you have an elevated PSA level, which is I'm going to get to the waiting in a second, but I have to tell a little story first. The PSA level goes up, and then you're confronted with a choice of whether to biopsy or not biopsy. Most people eventually, if this keeps on going up, will submit to a doctor's recommendation for a biopsy. And the biopsy frequently comes back as cancer, but cancer that's graded and staged as having a good prognosis. And people are presented with three options: surgery, radiation, or something that goes through, it keeps on changing its name, but its first name was watchful waiting. So I was getting to the waiting part of it. And kind of like the states of risk, in a way, a lot of the medical options and a lot of the results of our screening and risk paradigm result in ambiguous information that can be dealt with by waiting. The name is switched to active surveillance. There's a bunch of other terms that have changed and around it. Now, like the first thing, the actual phenomenological and lived experience, in some sense the career, of waiting is anything but absent. The person who's, like in the PSA example, kind of like the woman with the HPV, will get ultrasounds, repeat PSAs, free PSAs, repeat biopsies done. They'll be put on normograms. New biomarkers come in that get measured to see what their risk is. It's anything but like watching TV or waiting for a movie or a bus or something. It's an state that's filled with work but involves waiting, you know, and the word's still used, it's still, many people will call it that, that, and this is the thing I'm very interested in my book and in looking at, that in a sense becomes a state that becomes intolerable, that can only be cured by surgery or radiation. I don't know if you follow what I'm saying. And this gets to the career. There's so many, if you follow any of these risk paradigms or treatment of chronic disease where you're doing anticipatory treatment, getting back to time in a way which a lot of chronic disease treatment is, there are a series of like potential tests and interventions and anniversaries and things you're waiting to happen that become, you know, the image is sometimes used, the sword of Damocles over your head, you know, waiting to kill you. And this becomes a motivation to participate in more extreme measures to finally, like, kill the wait, so to speak. So I'm kind of just, like, trying to do double duty here with the career a little bit. I'm very tangible and material in my approach to things. And I'm sort of shocked and amazed about how much work, navigation, knowledge, set through a whole life course is often involved when one is given an anticipatory diagnosis or a risk state, and that's why I use the word career. I mean, I borrow it from sociologists, which, you know, often talk about the career of a diagnosis. It's not my own term. I think some early medicalization theorists often used it, but it seems appropriately fitting for the kind of work that people suspended in a waiting state of risk have to have, and it becomes the motivation for more extreme measures. And by the way, this is very old. I wrote a book about the history of breast cancer, and in the early 1910s and 20s, when radical surgery was introduced, one of the main rationales, the operation wasn't called Halsted mastectomy or radical mastectomy, it was called the complete operation for the cure of breast cancer. And the word complete was in a kind of semantic field with incomplete. You know, it's kind of one of these terms that by calling it that, it like defeats the opposition. And the idea was, before you had limited cures, you had things that were partial operations, the cancer came back, this was going to be a complete thing. So the logic of ending a period of waiting or a period of uncertainty with a more complete procedure is a logic that's deeply ingrained in you know, Western medicine, 20th century medicine, but exacerbated to the hilt by new medical knowledge and risk interventions.
I guess I'll just say a couple of thoughts on the waiting part. I like that you talk about the politics of waiting. I suppose given my background, I like to think about what are the ethics of waiting. Waiting is unavoidable. One might even say that one version of living is waiting. So what do you do in the course of the years that you have before you are sick or you do die or this period is over, so to speak? How do you make the most of the time that you're waiting? Waiting is an inevitable part of clinical care. I think like how you phrased it, that, you know, a lot of times we spend in the doctor's office, much of it is spent waiting. A lot of times we go in for surgery, pre-op or post-op, or we're spent waiting, so to speak. I suppose part of that for me as a literary person, in addition to being a historian of medicine, is trying to think, how do we best narratively attend to the necessity of the act of waiting? And I think that's by being mindful of the fact that we acknowledge that waiting is part of the process and that we are attuned to waiting can mean different things for different people. What is the quiet room that provides a balm and a solace, and a place of reflection for somebody not to feel the paranoia that sounds the culture of risk. For the other person is the room with white walls that drives them crazy, basically. So the same context can have a different reaction for two different people. If waiting, therefore, is a necessary part of clinical care, how perhaps do people wait in different ways? I'll give you a classic example. Anytime I've ever had to go into the emergency department, and if I've had a panic attack, if I've had an injury or a fall, it hasn't happened a lot, I'm not that accident prone or anything, but a few times, every time I've been relieved when I walk in and the treating team, whether it's the frontline nurses on call, whether it's the people at check-in, whether it's the many physicians I might see, the radiologist that might be called in, I am always relieved when that person, during both either my times of waiting or care, is, you know, just kind of like, it's normal Tuesday, not that big a deal. I'm freaking out. I'm worried. I'm in the emergency department. For them, it's not that big a deal. It's the equivalent of like whenever I'm on a plane and there's turbulence. Whether I want to get scared or not, I immediately grab the seat, as though that's going to save me, by the way. We're going down. Holding on to the chair ain't going to help. But I'm just instinctively worried. But what's the first thing I do, not out of instinct after I've grabbed the chair? I look for those stewards and stewardesses everywhere. And if I see them checking their nails, we're shaking all over, but they're checking their nails. No big deal. I am assuaged by the way with which they are not echoing for me my own alarm, basically. Having said that, there's plenty of people that come into the emergency department that in their periods and times of waiting, what they want is they want positively their worry or their alarm or their disquietude to be reflected back to them. I say that because between those two reactions and perhaps everyone in between, if waiting is a necessary part of clinical care and clinical practice and clinical interactions, then there probably actually is a quite range of difference of what makes and what looks like best waiting, basically. I want to give one other example about waiting and the ethics of waiting, where if waiting is a necessary part of life, what troubles me about waiting in certain contexts, where if waiting is supposed to be a virtue, if waiting is a virtue, what does that mean? It means you're patient. It means you're tolerant. It means that you're not too anxious. It means that you're gathered. But sometimes those aren't virtues. I'll tell you an example of waiting that I actually quite dislike. I don't know if anybody has ever heard of this movement for LGBT kids in high school and younger called It Gets Better. Now, I think it's a good strategy to tell these young people that there are future lives for yourself that are going to be better than whatever shitty predicament than you are right now. I think it's nice that people give testimonials. And basically, you know, this is a series of videos on YouTube put together. Dan Savage started, and all kinds of gay celebrities and adults have given testimonials about, look at my life now, look at my partner now, look at our family, it gets better. It's a wise, wise approach to want to curtail the high rates of suicide attempt and suicides actually in young people, in addition to just depression and dejection in general. But the philosophy behind it gets better, what's the logic behind that? Good things comes to those who wait. But the reason that frustrates me incredibly is, here's another euphemism for this, don't write a check you can't cash. Can you promise that those kids are going to have better lives when they get to college, when they're grown up? What regions of the world or the country that they live in, so to speak? I hope so. I hope it gets better. So maybe the problem there isn't just the fact that waiting is being sold to these kids. It's basically telling them, endure the shit you're dealing with right now, it gets better. Well, how about we go in there and help them where they are right now? How about maybe we say it gets better, but also realize that waiting is a useful strategy and a tool in vulnerable populations, but I don't think that waiting is sufficient to be the solution, so to speak. The irony, of course, of this is that the logic behind it gets better, when is better supposed to be? When you grow up, when is better supposed to be? In most cases, they mean something like, when you get to college, it'll get better. What started the It Gets Better movement was a kid who went to college in his freshman year, and he was publicly shamed for being gay, and he committed suicide. So tucked inside the historical narrative from where that movement comes from is this sense of, does it get better? And more importantly, how is waiting necessary, but how is sometimes something to be wary about also too?
It's not so much a lance, but things I forgot sort of to say, which was an obvious point that our medical knowledge, especially about finding earlier risk states, some early is a temporal metaphor that doesn't quite cut it, but I'll, for purpose of this discussion, I'll say leads people to, sorry. that leads people in a state of waiting about what might happen. And I guess one just classic example of this is an ethnography that some sociology colleagues of mine did of newborn kids. You know, every newborn, if you have a child in this country, you're tested for metabolic abnormalities. Not necessarily genetics. Usually they're done on more old-fashioned metabolic screens. And some of these things identify disorders like PKU and that have dietary implications. But the very volume and intensity of these tests, which are just, you know, with a little stick of a prick of a foot, you can do hundreds of tests on, find all this information. And many of the much of the information is unknown, of uncertain, you know, uncertain significance. And so he did an ethnography of a clinic where the kids are sent, many of which are, the name of the chapter is called Patients in Waiting, because these kids have a, you know, there's something real in their metabolic abnormality, but people don't know whether or not it has any consequences. And so the parents and the kids are newborns, so the parents are in a state of constant surveillance. They're told to look for something odd in their growth. Everything is measured developmentally. And then after about a year or two, if the kid doesn't show any kind of funky thing, the clinicians want to tell them, you know, geh gesunte, go and live your life. And the parents are like beside themselves with worry and concern, and they're like become addicted, and you know, they've had this child who's been waiting for something to happen, and they're not like ready to take medical advice to say stop waiting, just go off. You know, what does this thing mean? And the more tests we have, and the more knowledge we have, people have a set of potential things to wait for. And often, since we don't have good knowledge about the real natural history of any of these early states and any of these laboratory abnormalities, it's complete medical uncertainty. So both the physicians and the medical and the scientific establishment are waiting.
I want to shift gears a little bit, and this question is directed to you, Lance, but of course it's for both. Robbie's idea of the patient as career like reminds me of something that you talked about when I was in your class, the science of sex and sexuality, and it's in regards to the experiences of trans and gender nonconforming folks in the clinic. You and other people like Dean Spade and other theorists, you talk about the need to produce or to perform a particular type of narrative, which is often pathologizing in order to meet the diagnostic criteria from the DSM and other guidelines, et cetera, in order to like literally receive medication or hormones or surgery. And you know, it's often in those cases where bioethicists are consulted for their expert opinion to talk about whether or not it's legitimate. And the like experience and the knowledge of the patient comes into question then because of the fears and anxieties of the medical practitioner. So can you talk about what it means to do, or what it looks like to do, a queer bioethics in those cases?
Well, the work I do on bioethics related towards queer populations is a sort of twofold. On the one hand, I'm really interested in thinking about where in bioethics do we see queer subjecthood? Individuals, persons, identities, communities, particular vulnerabilities, health, socioeconomic-wise, whatever. I often refer to this as these are the nouns of queer that I look for, the things in the room, the inventory I want to take. But the other part of my work is queering as a verb. Bioethics, as it's done on a daily basis, what is it to think about hospice and end-of-life care? What is it to think about patient autonomy? What is it to think about the most generic bioethics things we do, and what is it like to queer them? How does the ethics of a situation change when we think about the queer subjectivity or the queer lens that we might look at a case through? In terms of thinking about how we diagnose, and in particular, how bioethics intervenes sometimes in terms of trying to think about, and this is the right word to use, when does medicine have the function to legitimate, basically, identities and categories of individual? Queer individuals have a long and storied history, popular guy, we have a long and storied history where a lot of the terms that we use for gender and sexual non-normativity, lesbian, transsexual, transvestite, transgendered, homosexual, etc. These are terms that actually come out of the history of sexology at the end of the 19th century, so tucked within the very nomenclature and even the logic of thinking about people as being queer, not behavior, not sex acts, but people being queer. Pathology is the historical sort of undergirding of that sort of logic. a lot of the efforts on behalf of queer activists, or LGBT activists, probably more accurately, we call them in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, were attempts to repeatedly want to de-medicalize, de-pathologize categories of LGBTQ. And the most famous and the first classic example is when homosexuality was taken out of the DSM in 1973 based on pressures by homosexual rights and LGBT rights activist groups. And this was supposed to be the beginning of dominoes falling in terms of de-medicalizing queer populations. The tragic part of this narrative, of course, is that in 73, if that depathologization happens, 8 years later is when HIV and AIDS is first identified and isolated. So that's quite a quick shift of the pendulum from wanting to go entirely away from medicine to being thrust back into it as part of a community. With that in mind, let me just mention to you that part of what bioethics does and part of what medicine does when it diagnoses or pathologizes is that on the one hand, it's not hard to see the correlation between being pathologized and being stigmatized. This is what you are, and that makes you sick. This is the kind of body that you have, and that makes you anomalous or disabled or infirmed or different in some way. But there's positives that come out of being pathologized too. For every queer person throughout the 20th century that had some rejection or some resistance to the way medicine was articulating the pathology, when sexology came onto the scene and started articulating a vast vocabulary of how to talk about sexual and gender difference in a way that had never been made possible, having that vocabulary, having that discourse, that perspicacity to speak at great length and great complexity, it was welcomed by people that we would now call queer. Which is to say, having language and having a context that language gives legitimacy. So there is a stigmatizing side effect that comes from pathology, but there's a rewarding one that comes too. If I said homosexuals and lesbians in the LGBT movement wanted very hard in the 70s to remove homosexuality from the DSM, and they did, trans persons have not had that same urgency. And it's sort of invoked what you talked about, Sheila. For trans individuals, the ability for themselves to have access to certain kinds of clinical care, to have that care be covered by insurance as not elective but essential kind of care, it's not possible without a pathological diagnosis. So if the DSM, under the American Psychiatric Association, can seem like a stigmatizing agent for some individuals, it actually can be a quite legitimating agent as well. In the same way that if you think about a land parcel piece of legislation in the United States, for example, like the Americans with Disabilities Act, for example, to receive those civil and those municipal and those federal protections to qualify under the Americans with Disabilities Act, you need a diagnosis that says you're disabled, basically. So the stigma that could seem to come from that particular kind of labeling can have rewards too at the same time. Let me just give you one example about something that speaks to this textual way in which we see stigma. The DSM actually just got, it's a text that dates from just after the Second World War, and it's been revised on an annual basis, but they've only overhauled that thing 5 times in the last 70 years. They just did DSM-5 about 2 or 3 years ago, basically. I was actually asked to testify on a couple of occasions before the revision panel on 2 subjects, and I'll just tell you what they were. One of those subjects I was asked to talk about was, as a historian, I was just telling them, here are narratives on this, here is the history on this. The DSM is a living, breathing medical document because what constitutes mental healthiness positively changes based on what cultural standards are in a current moment. I was asked to talk about sex addiction, and I was asked to talk about what was then called gender identity disorder, and it's now called gender dysphoria. I basically told the American Psychiatric Association, revising a medical text, there's many ways to revise, but there's really only four main moves you can make. The first thing you can determine is, do we have the name of the condition right in the text that we have? That was why I was asked to talk about gender identity disorder. That's the term that gets used to say you have a pathological diagnosis for why you're a trans person. You deserve to be able to have the treatments. Now, granted, there's gatekeeping mechanism after gatekeeping mechanism to receive those rewards, but having a term is important. And so the revision they said was, we don't like gender identity disorder. Can we change it to gender dysphoria? Some of it's semantics, some of it's also the fact of whether or not language needs to evolve, and that was what happened. They didn't largely change the prerequisites or what does gender non-normativity present itself or look like or what have you. The term changed. Second thing you can do, you can change the definition. You can change substantially what counts, what qualifies, what does this disease or what does this condition normally present itself as, what's best course of treatment. Get the name right, get the definition right. The third move you've got is, do you have it in the right place in the book? it's not just an alphabetical text. So one of the things is, do you have these diagnoses in the right place in the book? That was why I was asked to talk about sex addiction. I basically talked about the fact that sex addiction for me felt like, and by the way, if you don't know, most sexual dysfunctions that were in the DSM before the 1970s had a lot to do with whether people were hypersexual, masturbating too much, not being promiscuous, not being monogamous, so on. By the 1970s, the DSM had been revised, and a larger percentage of hyposexual disorders were there, so not being in touch enough with your sexuality. So what constitutes sexual healthiness is absolutely changing. When it comes to sex addiction, I said, I don't know that it needs to be in the sex addiction portion of the book. Perhaps it should be in the obsessive compulsive disorder section of the book, as I showed a lot of clinical literature has said. And they ended up doing it, not because I said it, but I think because that's why I saw it trending. Do you have the name right? Do you have the definition right? Do you have it in the right place in the book? Your only other move is, should it be in the book at all? And that was what LGBT people wanted in the 70s, get us out of this book. Only to find, whether because of necessity, because an epidemic came later, and far from turning your back on medicine, everybody's going to need it at some point. There are legitimacies that also come from being pathologized and stigmatized. So walking that fine line, I think, is part of what that's about.
I just want to, I'm sure Lance knows this, but extend Lance's point of view that medicalization, let alone medical, other forms of medical intervention, don't necessarily need to be put in the column of always to be abhorred and bad. To take the 19th century example, I don't know if you're familiar with Bert Hansen's article about the sort of neurological discovery of homosexuality in New York in the 19th century, where it became a kind of, it seems very naive and stupid and stigmatizing reading it, but there was a kind of flip side of it that recognized that there was, it wasn't just necessarily an aberrant behavior that sailors on a ship without access to the right target might do, but a kind of an essential way of being that was part of the medicalization model. Just add just one more little piece of data to Lance's point, which I thoroughly agree with. And maybe you have more. I have something else I want to say, but forget it.
Yeah. So I wanted to throw one other question. I do realize that it's getting late, so feel free to talk about this briefly or at length as you so choose. It in a way, it builds upon what you've already been talking about. Communities of color, marginalized groups, have historically received inequitable treatment. There's been so many barriers to receiving treatment at all, and in fundamental ways to even being received with empathy. So how does the conversation around risk, around fear, around uncertainty play out across race and class and gender? For many, and tonight we've talked about how fear often is connected to anticipated or actual diagnoses, but it's often the diagnostician or the field of healthcare that one fears for communities of color. And so are these different fears? Are these the same fears? Like, what would a taxonomy of fear look like? And how can we, I mean, again, you've already both been speaking to this, but how can we care differently in response?
So maybe I'll just make my Debbie Downer point first, which has to do with the, it's not a direct answer to your question, but it's, in a sense, a fear I have of my own, which is the exploitation of the discourse around racial, gender, and socioeconomic inequalities to rationalize risk interventions that target those groups as if they were an unmitigated, wonderful thing. And I'm thinking of things like, and essentially the medicalization of obesity, where there's socioeconomic, racial, stigmatized minority associations with it, and it's thought of only as a benevolent thing, and only thought of in terms of structural reasons that allow food deserts and inadequate sources, when in fact we're also stigmatizing a group of people and giving them another reason why they shouldn't be successful or given equal opportunities. It's not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, it's just something I worry about. A similar thing has been done by the promoters of PSA tests, whatever, to talk about prostate cancer as an African-American disease. And with the point of selling more a certain kind of intervention and using a kind of disparity for very particular ends. And there's a whole slew of gender examples I could give you as well. So, one just worry I have a bit, and I live in a world, I ran a health disparity, this Robert Wood Johnson program was really aimed at addressing health disparities, but I often would raise a little bit of objections to some of my colleagues who were so quick to see some of these things as essentializing and not understand some of the downsides of some well-intentioned attempts to address disparities. Mm-hmm.
I'll answer with just an anecdote, and it actually speaks to the thing you're talking about, but actually maybe from the side of where I really want people to pay attention to just what if, where we think about risk. In fact, when I was invited to this panel and the question was about the theme of risk or whatever, risk comes up most literally in the work I do, in particular in stuff I do with HIV-positive patients and potentially HIV-positive patients. It was about 3 or 4 years ago, I was asked to give a talk at the CDC. So you're all familiar with pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is a kind of, you know, Truvada is the most the approved example, basically. And basically, it's a way with which you can prevent acquiring HIV by taking HIV medication even while you're negative, basically. Controversial in some ways because we don't know the long-term side effects. Controversial because of the ways that it changes. What has been the cornerstone of safe sex practice has been discourse and condom use and having knowing what is best safe practices to now it just seems pharmacologic in some way, so to speak. So it has its own controversies. I was asked by the CDC to talk because they had acquired the possibility to make recommendations to the federal government that certain municipalities could get federal funds to cover, in totality, the payment of PrEP for certain populations. And so I and about, I don't know, 10 other people were called in for various reasons. I was called in as the queer bioethicist history guy, basically, to say, if you had to pick one population, statistically, where a municipality, if they wanted to apply for money, where it could be put to the best use to meet the most people, note that there isn't an endless amount of money, so don't just say, people of color, like that's too big a number, basically. But try to find it in the sweet spot so the most people can get met for the highest risk they might have. And in this case, I walked through a history of who are the patient populations with the highest susceptibility for HIV and AIDS in the first 2 decades, most of whom are still vulnerable. They're called the H group sometimes, homosexuals, hemophiliacs, heroin users, sex workers or hookers as they might be called, Haitians was a population as well. Just to say, for whatever reasons, persons living in sexual communities that were newly formed where the contagious disease was found, like gay men, people who were IV drug users who were sharing needles, and it wasn't just the sharing of needles, it was the fact that needles were being shared and rented by the dozens of times. It was exponentially worse, the economics of drug trade and addiction. In the case of hemophiliacs, it was whether there was a tainted blood supply for children who needed transfusions. In the case of sex workers, it was their own poverty and stripes that made them get into the line of sex work, not their moral depravity or what have you. It was their financial woe and needs. And in the case of Haitians, it's poverty, close living communities, poor infrastructure, lack of education and dissemination that makes it possible. There's nothing particular about Haitian bodies or Haitian lives that make them predisposed towards HIV. It just so happens that HIV first made it man itself in a major way in North America. And if you contacted, you know, the United Nations or some other place and asked for the GDPs of every country in the Western Hemisphere, guess who's number one on the list? Haiti. So poverty and lack of resources extends to this. I just went through that list and I said, if you really want to cut down this list, it has a lot to do with people who are sexual and gender non-normative, people who might have a history of drug addiction, people who come from backgrounds where there might be poverty, women of color, persons of color living in poorer neighborhoods are highly susceptible. My conclusion was to the CDC, the biggest bang for your buck, if you're going to fund printing, should be for transgender women of colors who are sex workers. It's a specific enough population that hits enough of these riskier, vulnerable points that I would recommend it. And they took a recommendation. It was one of, I think, 5 options they ended up having for a successful, statistically most bang for a buck recommendation municipally. Well, if you don't know, back in January, the Trump administration sent a memo to the CDC saying if anybody's looking to get funding from the federal government through an application through the CDC, you are not allowed to use 7 words in any of your proposals. Or if you do use those 7 words, you will be sort of demoted down the list. I won't tell you what all 7 of them are, but 3 of them are marginalized, vulnerable, transgender. So to name or not to name risk has consequences in both directions. I remember when I read that in the newspaper, I thought, well, there goes my recommendation, I guess.
So the last question that Aaron and I will ask has to do with something we've been talking about broadly, politics of listening and care. Central to both of your works is the importance of actually listening to the patient, centering their own experiences and their own desires. And so from your perspectives, like, what would it actually look like to practice a deep listening and care and center the patient in healthcare? How would that change our understanding of what it means to care for another?
And then just further accentuating that, like, can we reverse the much lamented breakdown in the relationship between the provider and the patient, despite all of the neoliberal kind of transformations to healthcare in this century and last century? Can we counter the loss of that fundamental relationship? And how?
Okay. I guess I'll start. I don't want to say this is the major cause of problematic doctor-patient relationships, dehumanizing medical experiences, and, you know, things that both of you have mentioned as problems, lack of empathy and care. But the little part of it, or the big part of it, that I've tried to research and push, and I guess I'd like to just at least throw out for some discussion, is the role of medical knowledge and you know, what I call risky medicine, risk-centered medicine, and what it does. And this is what I mean by it. Unlike going to a doctor with some felt experience, some symptom that bothers you, patient-initiated complaint with all its idiosyncrasy. You know, your pain is different from my pain. My whole medical experience is very different. There's a kind of leveling and erasure of the individual that happens when medicine is so focused on treating abnormalities picked up on screening, anticipated by medical knowledge in the future. In a way, it erases a lot of the individual with all their complex suffering. Now, it's not complete. There's idiosyncratic combinations of risk factors and other things that happen, and people actually deal with their own fears in different ways. But in many ways, it's a move. And you can see this also in the way medicine is disciplined, you know, the quality assurance measures that look at these things as indicators of what's happening, of measures of population health and good outcome, and medical report cards. What's countable is what gets counted, you know, around it. So that's part of my diagnosis, let's say, of where the dehumanizing, lack of empathy, reduction of the individual happens. And with that diagnosis comes a remedy or a cure to pull back. and this is somewhat ironic given the fact my first book had a lot to do with issues that made us, that could be seen to have a contradictory point. But I think medicine has lost its way in terms of not focusing on actual disease, an actual symptomatic illness, and has sort of bound itself up in a lot of complications that erase the individual and its suffering. This is somewhat orthogonal, but one of my good friends, who's kind of the master clinician, I think of in Philadelphia, gets a lot of problematic patients who have escaped a good diagnosis and treatment and come in with log charts. And he describes his work as decluttering the history, the way in which the performative aspects of each diagnosis leads to more diagnoses and more tests. And goes back where he can, if it's at all recoverable, to the patient who has a certain set of symptoms and lived experiences that, you know, of course, they're implicated completely with medical interventions and stuff. So it's very hard to disaggregate and declutter in this way. But it's part of the solution from the medical knowledge and research and policy level, but it's also at the clinical level that, you know, maybe is amenable with better medical education and maybe different ways of reimbursing and rewarding care. But I don't pretend to say that's the whole problem, but it's a kind of neglected aspect sometimes. You think if you teach medical students to be more empathetic and take some literature classes and go around the Slough Gallery and look at art, you know, like that, you know, which are important, but it's not, you know, there's a kind of tough thing, I think, about sort of the way medical knowledge and the actual medical work is being made that needs to be remedied.
When you asked the question, is there hope for teaching, you know, more empathetic ways to act and talk and listen to doctors and patients?
I
thought a funny answer would be no. Because if that was the case, then I'm out of a job, because I'm a professor in a medical school with a PhD in English who's a historian. So clearly I must have some investment in the fact that there's a function, there's a value to thinking about ways with which to think about talking and listening and so on. You use the phrase deep listening its analog for those of us who are literary scholars might be something like close reading, which is to say, what is it to hold up for examination or for study with sensitivity and with deafness and closeness, that thing. I have to teach narrative medicine things, things about medical practice and talking to patients, not just here at Penn, but across the United States and internationally even. And if there's a pushback at time from clinical teams, it's sometimes about something to the effect of like, find me 10 more minutes in the day and I'll be glad to talk to patients more, but it's hard to do. Which is to say, I try not to push too much this model that we're supposed to be talking more and saying more all the time. In fact, we are probably better at doing this kind of repair for a provider-patient interaction, or a better term of shoring up that relationship, if the mindfulness of the way that we communicate is more important than the fact that we need to communicate more, basically. Which is to say, the interactions and the communications that are essential and a part of just delivering care and receiving the information that we need in order to make the diagnostics to deliver the medicine back, just in those conversations with mindfulness and with nuance, with close reading, with active listening and close listening, I think we can make a difference. There's a whole host of programs that tell you how to listen actively and how best to talk to patients and say things back to them. And I'm sure there are tips and tools, but I think the mindfulness of sort of what that is valuable. I say this because rather than saying that medicine needs more narrative or needs more or listening or what have you, it's more important to realize that medicine, and in its most literal sense, a lot of it is about listening and talking. As historians, we talk about sometimes that when you look at history or the history of literature or the history of narratives or texts, you think that those texts, you go to the archive because it's valuable, because that novel or those letters will record what medicine was like at that time. Any historian worth their metal will know absolutely that material is good for receiving what medicine was like, but that material probably changes also how medicine was practiced, and if nothing else, just how it's disseminated in the world and the expectations people have for what their encounter likes, the language they need to use, the conversations they have. We see this all the time. I see articles on this in like Nejm and JAMA, like at least every 6 years when there's a new doctor's show on TV that's a big hit, and they'll show surveys and studies that they've done about patients' expectations for what they get in medicine as affected by Grey's Anatomy or something, how things get disseminated in the world to narrative and how they double back also. The kind of narrative I like to talk about, and I think this speaks to the listening and the active, is that I do think that most medicine actually has a lot to do with the fact that when you're giving the medicine to the person in terms of diagnosis or conversation or checkup or what have you, the narrative that's couched in there actually is essential and is a part of how medical care happens. There are literal examples. The talking cure is the most famous example where the talking is the therapy, basically. But there's plenty of other examples when people go to group therapy, when people take part in active reading together for learning and lessons. Narrative, listening, reading, aren't so much, I think, a satellite of what makes best medicine. I think they might be the nucleus.